This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Vanity Fair.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
I am delighted and proud to introduce him as Academy Award winner.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
The winner, it's a tie.
And any little girl who's practicing their speech on the telly, you never know.
Mom, I just want an Oscar.
I am David Canfield, and I'm here for today's interview episode with Chris Murphy. Hi, Chris.
Hi, David. It's so nice to be back.
Welcome back. Always a pleasure to have you. Today, we have interviews with two queens of HBO.
Oh, yeah.
Two of my favorite actors, period, which I'm very excited about. I spoke with Sandra Oh, star of The Sympathizer, and, you know, star of the screen for many decades, in many great roles. And you, a little later, will hear your conversation with Carrie Coon, who's currently up for consideration for The Gilded Age. And I'm not sure if you spoke to her while she was in Thailand filming The White Lotus, but I know that was touched on as well.
Oh, yeah. She had just gotten back to see her family and her kids, and she was off to Thailand at the end of the week. So the New York to Thailand commute, it's pretty rough.
So I've heard. So I'm sure we'll hear. But let's start with my conversation with Sandra. In The Sympathizer, she plays Sophia Mori, who is a love interest to the protagonist of that show, which we talked about a little bit last week. The protagonist is known as the Captain, and he is battling these dual identities as a refugee post-Vietnam War in the United States, who's also working as a spy for the communist regime. So this is a supporting part for Sandra. She's just coming off of a really celebrated lead run in Killing Eve. And I found the way she talked about being a part of a production with a largely Vietnamese cast of actors who have not worked a lot or had the opportunity to work a lot. I'm really moving and hearing her reflect as an industry veteran on just being a part of that and how much that meant to her.
To turn around and see on this carpet all the faces, all the Vietnamese faces, it makes me emotional in a way that I'm actually glad it's going to be different for them, because I want them to think and feel like this is absolutely normal and this is the way it should be. To be able to be present and supporting to see that opportunity coming about, it does. It makes me emotional.
In this show, she also gets to be sexy. She gets to really embrace the genre of this show, this sort of noirish, almost femme fatale kind of figure. And just the way she even holds a cigarette, as I tell her, it's delicious to watch her get to play around with that.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, let's get into this conversation with Sandra Oh. Sandra Oh, thank you so much for joining us to talk about The Sympathizer. One of the best new shows of the year. I'm so excited to talk to you about this show.
Thanks so much. I'm so happy to be here with you.
I wanted to start really with your, you know, the way you got cast in this show. I'd read that Viet Thanh Nguyen, who wrote the book on which this is based, wanted you for the part. So how did that How did that look on your end?
Oh, no, that I was very pleased. It was Yet Who and Director Park, I would say.
Oh, wow.
It was their request. And Don McKellar and Niamh Fitchman, Don McKellar, who's the co-showrunner mm-hmm. along with Director Park, is a longtime collaborator of mine. We're both Canadian.
The Canada strong.
I think this is like, I don't know, the 10th project that we've done together.
Oh, wow. So
when Viet Dan and Wen's asked, and also Director Park asked, you know, Don just picked up the phone and said, meet us for dinner. And I was like, sure, no problem.
What do you remember about that first conversation about a really ambitious, complicated project and a complicated character who we'll definitely talk about occupies an interesting space within this narrative?
I had absolute confidence mm-hmm. in Director Park and in Don McKellar. You know, because knowing Don as much and as long as I have, I knew that he and Director Park would be able to bring to the page and then obviously bring to the screen extremely dense and oblique and very challenging material, and to make it into the spy thriller that it mm-hmm. is. So it's extremely layered piece, you know? Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of times where I would be talking to Don about a lot of very, very, very oblique dialogue, but mm-hmm. that in terms of it being correct for a spy thriller, I was like, okay, I get it.
I love you focusing on genre here, because that's obviously so central to the conceit of both the novel and the series. And the way you get to enter this show in episode 2, which just aired, even just the way you hold your cigarette, like you are so in the mode, I think, of this milieu and this world. Can you talk about stepping into that space and, from what I could see, having a little bit of fun with it?
Oh, yeah. that is true. You know, Sophia Mori, when we were introduced to her in episode 2, she's working as a secretary mm-hmm. in the, quote, Oriental Studies Department at, you know, basically UCLA. And she, I think, brings a real lightness to the captain. So I could really see that Sophia was there to bring just another dynamic and another, also very important for the captain's journey, for him to see what could be possible if he was able to tell the truth mm-hmm. and if he was able to show who he really is.
In terms of her sexuality, there's a fascinating kind of forthrightness to her in a lot of ways that I found really exciting for the way you get to play her, the way she's written. Talk about that part of it and allowing that part of the character to really shine through.
Oh, definitely. In the book, in my interpretation on the page, Sophia Mori is very much a sexually liberated lady. Mm-hmm. But also what I was interested in is there's a little bit of she doth protest too much mm-hmm. in her need to identify herself as solely American. And what I really understand that to be, you know, of that time is that type of assimilation is really coming from a need for survival. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? But I think that Sophia really believes that it's her own choice at the beginning. I think as we track her through this series, she starts questioning what her identity is and if her identity can be more than the defense of claiming just being an American.
You know, you're very blunt. It's not very Oriental of you.
I'm an American. I see you. I see how you act around our dear professor, always smiling like the good Asian student you used to be. I recognize the suit.
You wound me, Miss Mori, but I can take it. When faced by an unexpected turn of events, I say, huh, I expected this.
But yeah, I love that she is like a chain-smoking, very independent, sexually free woman. Also, I think quite of her time. Of that time and before her time.
Was there any particular kind of research or insights you developed into that period where you say of her time? Because I think that's very true. And I'm curious what you mean by that.
You know, I think that there was a bit of a performative aspect to it. Mm-hmm. A little bit of really trying on clothing, or trying on. There was almost a defiance to even the way that I would choose to smoke. There was a defiance, right, almost in the way that when she entered, when you know, the captain will take her on, you know, to certain events, what she chooses to wear and how she chooses, mm-hmm, to present herself, and even the body language. There's a little bit of defiance with it. And I also think that it's very important that Sophia, Ms. Mori, is holding the place of Asian Americans already established in America, mm-hmm, while, you know, the captain and the majority of the cast, you know what I mean, are of the Vietnamese refugees who make it here to L.A. And so she's really, I feel, kind of elbowing her space in her, in the way that she kind of tries to move in her sexuality, to say that, you know, don't shame me for it. But there's a little bit of, for me, there was a little bit of a performative aspect to it. Yeah.
I think that's also something that exists within genre, right? Is seeing characters take up that space a little bit more willingly, maybe. With that idea of defiance, which I love the way you put it, it's not something I've necessarily gotten to see you play too often, and it was kind of a joy. Did it feel like getting to do something a little bit different, introducing a character and the way she introduces herself in a different way, maybe?
Sure. You know, even though it's, you know, a period piece, Ms. Mori considers herself a very modern and sexual woman. Mm-hmm. And that is always, you know... I'd like to consider myself that as well. I don't know. Maybe I've chilled out a little bit more, you know what I mean? Or settle into things in midlife.
I'm Nomi Fry, and this week on Critics at Large, we're talking about the delights and shortcomings of the new movie Challengers. It starred Zendaya at the center of a tennis triangle, and a very steamy love triangle.
Who are her loyalties to? Will she be tempted by the other one? How do these guys reckon their professional playing ambition with their romantic and sexual feelings about this mysterious woman? And such we have it. We have a conflict between three people in a game meant for two.
Is it a sports movie or a sex movie? Find out on Critics at Large from The New Yorker. New episodes drop every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How is your social battery right now? What's the right amount of socializing for you? And how do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/littlegoldmen today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/littlegoldmen. So you mentioned earlier realizing that Ms. Mori was sort of essential to the captain's journey. And I find that really interesting just in terms of your presence on this show. I had read that when you started filming on the show, you had said to The New Yorker, I'm going to quote you. You said, "You've never been so clear on how to lend support being a part of this project." I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what you meant by that.
Sure. You know, I was thinking about this today, that there have been, mostly for me, actors in the African-American community who, they don't even know this. they probably don't even know this. But their words of support have really buoyed me along my career. And I feel like I wanted to be there in a supportive way for potentially a new community of actors who might be unfamiliar with the scope and, honestly, the union rules. You know what I mean? Just what their rights are, right? As an actor, and what you can ask for. Because, you know, for someone like, I, you know what, almost all the cast members, except for maybe a few of the Vietnamese characters, joined SAG.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So there are moments where it's like, how are they supposed to know? They don't know, like, what, you need lunch.
Yeah, 100%.
Just certain things like that are certain things to lend a hand of protection because, you know, Hua had such a huge responsibility on his shoulders. I wanted him to succeed. And sometimes you just don't know who to approach or who to ask. You don't know what to ask for. And I wanted to make myself the safest place to be that advocate. And that I felt was a real eye-opening and learning process. A learning process in understanding my own career.
Mm.
Like what I'm here for. Or I should say, one of the things I am here for, how I can lend or help with a puzzle piece in the great puzzle of all of it. You know, it's like, what I hope is that the cast was not intimidated to ask me anything. Mm. I tried to make myself as welcoming as possible. So when they need and if they needed anything, I would be able to help support them.
It is, you know, for the viewer, this experience of, and I've had this with Shogun as well. I think these are personally my two favorite shows of the year. A lot of actors that certainly I've never seen before, most American audiences at least have never seen before, getting this opportunity to show what they can do.
Mm-hmm. It's great because it's also like profoundly satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
It's profoundly satisfying to see a cast being able to fulfill their full potential. And not only that, it being supported.
Mm.
There are always different ingredients that you really, really need. A great script, a great mm-hmm. director, great cast, and, you know, a studio like supporting you by bringing it out to the world. And, you know, people like yourselves who are like, oh, no, this is interesting to me. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to choose this to talk about. And we're all a part of it, right? Everyone has their piece in it, you know? And even like this, so we had our premiere yesterday. The red carpet, it is, I mean, they don't have the same feeling as I do, but it's like, I don't know how many times I have been on a carpet, you know, for the past 25 years, one, trying to get onto a carpet, mm-hmm. being on a carpet and being completely ignored, mm-hmm. to then the growth of it for me, right? And then to turn around and see on this carpet all the faces, all the Vietnamese faces.
Mm.
It makes me emotional in a way that I'm actually glad it's going to be different for them because I want them to think and feel like this is absolutely normal and this is the way it should be. You know, I come from a slightly different generation I don't know how to talk about that yet, but I don't know how to talk about it yet. But I came from a time where there just weren't a lot of us who had that opportunity. So to be able to be present and supporting to see that opportunity coming about, it's like, it does. It makes me emotional. Just makes me emotional to just even be a part of it. I mean, but I also honestly, I felt it in the past while with other like films, like with other films. Like I remember like being at the Oscars with Everything, you know, meaning I wasn't at the Oscars with them, but it like being two rows behind them, but witnessing all of it, my head was exploding with so much joy for them all. Mm. And, kind of feeling and understanding for the first time a part of the whole for me, you know, that it's not individuals. I don't exactly know how to talk about it, but that's a feeling that is coming up for me only in the past like few years, feeling like my part in the whole of it. And that feeling being a profoundly satisfying one.
Hmm.
Yeah.
In that experience that you're talking about of these last few years, has it impacted the kinds of roles you're looking for, the kinds of things you're saying no to, even versus maybe like just pre-Killing Eve as a timeline? Like how has that impacted the kind of work you want to do?
Yes, because I feel like I now have the great opportunity of being much more discerning.
Hmm.
And understanding there's a responsibility to be discerning and where I put the support and energy and my experience behind, You know what I mean? So that's, you just got to be smarter about this. Actually, you want to know what? I remember talking to, I was having dinner with Awkwafina, and she actually said that to me. She goes, you just got to be really smart with your choices. And what I understand is that it can take a real lifetime to be able to reach the point of having the freedom to be discerning. So I take that very seriously. Mm.
One other way in which I feel like the Sympathizer is an exciting change of pace for you is I associate you, particularly on television, working with iconic writers, showrunners like Shonda Rhimes, Phoebe Waller-Bridge. And this is it's a director-driven series in a lot of ways. You mentioned director Park, whose style is all over the show in the best way. I'm just wondering, given your extensive experience in television, how you found working with him, what that collaboration was like, how you observed him, things like that.
Amazing. Amazing. And different, because you have three filmmakers, Park Chan-wook, Fernando Mireles, and Mark Munden, who directed the last three, I think, three episodes of the show, English director. And so, you know, I came from independent film, so I understand that language, and I also have a lot of experience in television. So this just being a new experience, and a new experience when you have very strong helmers who have very, very strong vision. Personally, I really like that. But, and also we had the benefit of, like, you know, Don McKellar, if I don't get a line, I just text him. I just call him. I say, what is this? And so, so to be able to have great access to the writer and his team of writers, and to have all the scripts so kind of clearly defined, and very, very ambitious scripts, it was the best of both worlds. But I just also want to mention, you know, all the things that I realize that are possible, even when you have like a series that is primarily in a different language that you are reading in subtitles. You know, when we're shooting this, you know, with director Park, there's three languages going on the whole time. And when they shot in Thailand, that's four languages going on, you know, and it's all possible. And it brings, I just feel like people stand up a little bit straighter and lean in to listen a little bit clearer. And everyone brought their best.
I think that's also true of what the show accomplishes. There's a profile of director Park in the New Yorker, and a big central theme of it is this idea of him making films and television that you really have to pay attention to. That is not for, you know, maybe what many consider the current era of consumption of texting while you're watching something. And there's a level of detail. How did you observe that on the set? And what do you just make of being a part of a show that is
so... Yeah, you want to know what? It's like, it is very much director Park's style and his strength and his standing firm to his vision. And you do have to lean in. You do have to lean in. I really think that this show should be studied.
Yeah, I agree.
I really do, because I'm now on the second round of watching everything. And you know, I shot the damn thing, right? I mean, like, I read the book, right? It is a dense book, and it is a dense series. And it also trips along and is completely entertaining in its genre. And I will say, on my second viewing, it then becomes like transfixing. It becomes transfixing, because then suddenly all the layers that I think director Park and Don have been layering in like this, then I'm catching all the pieces. And then I just was transfixed the second time around. And I don't mean to say that in an intimidating way. I actually mean to say that in a completely inviting way, because I was just like, holy, wow, what is in here? Like, I so desperately want to talk about, like, further episodes, like 104 and then 106, because there's so much meta And there's so much layering. There's so much layering that we can talk about in the casting of Robert Downey Jr. And there's so much layering in the captain's relationship with Moon. How the structure of the entire piece kind of is revealed in episodes 6 and 7. So then when you go back, you see all the hints of how they're laying out the structure that's going to be revealed in 6 and 7, particularly 7. Yeah.
You mentioned 4. It hasn't aired yet, but it is broadly known, reported, that this is an episode pretty focused on Hollywood. Can you talk maybe broadly about just that part of the book and knowing that skewering that we do get and how you, what you thought of it?
I think episode 4 is brilliant.
I do too.
I think Fernando just hit it out of the park. I think everyone did. I think all the cast members did. All our beautiful cast who joined us, John Cho and Dave Duchovny. I mean, everyone just brought it. I mean, you should really talk to Viet about this.
Yeah.
But there are so many references upon references. Obviously, again, Robert playing the auteur. You get references upon references of, you know, his own past filmography, of what just his persona in playing the auteur means. And I've just started talking about that and about this. So forgive me if it feels a little bit rough. There's so much satire in 104. And there's so much overt racism in 104. But because of the perspective, which is the captain's perspective, myself as an Asian American watching it, I'm not hurt by it. I'm inside of it. We're seeing played out, but in the safety of the captain's point of view, we're seeing played out how a Vietnamese people's voices have been completely obliterated from the Western American telling of the war in Vietnam. And then what has happened with the voice being missing for 50 years. So there's a lot of pain in it, and there's a lot of high satire in it. And I do think it's just fantastic. I could talk on and on and on.
With that, I'd love to close by asking you kind of a big picture question, because it's fascinating to me that, at least in American television, you break out in Grey's Anatomy, and you've talked a lot about the severe limits that came with exploring race and ethnicity in that show, just given that it was a network drama in the mid-2000s, if nothing else. And here you are 20 years later in The Sympathizer, which even now is pretty radical for what American television can do and have that kind of confrontation and spark that kind of conversation in that regard. What do you make of being a part of that kind of evolution of television? Not to say we're in an incredible space or anything, but it's growth, right?
Gosh, I'll take your word, evolution. And you're right. God, I've been around that long. I can see things evolved, you know? But it is great. It is great. And I would correct your word of limit, because it was definitely a choice. And a specific choice that I think that was right for the time that Shonda and the writers made it was a choice. And that was then explored later on, but you know, the show's been on for like 20 years. So
yeah, all the eras we're talking about.
Yeah,
it has
evolved as we have evolved. And again, this is another piece in the puzzle. I don't know, maybe a step towards the evolution of all points of view being valid. And extremely interesting. So interesting. I cannot tell you enough. Every single cast member, right? Vietnamese cast member. Yep. Like one of the best things for me was sitting in the chair, a circle of chairs. So there's, you know, in episode 3, there's a scene where almost all of the cast members are gathered, right? And so kind of sitting around are the cast chairs and everyone kind of just shooting the shit and people's stories. Fascinating, deep, rich, very complicated, you know, and that's the difference between, you know, the younger generation who are children of refugees, or mm-hmm. children of immigrants, and then those who came as refugees and immigrants, and how their approach to the material and how they are emotionally attached to the material, even the differences in that, really worth someone doing a much deeper dive into. There is a lot to be said. There's a lot to be told, yeah.
So, Chris, now we're going to turn to your conversation with Carrie Coon. And I'm excited for this because as soon as it ended, our producer, Brett, sent me a message telling me that was a fun one. and Brett doesn't overhype.
I love that. Well, I hate to play favorites, but I have to say, Carrie Coon is one of my favorite actresses and one of my favorite conversations or people that I get to have conversations with because she's just so darn funny. We talked about everything from the Gilded Age season 2 and the surprise of the renewal that she was not necessarily expecting, which was pretty exciting. We talked about her obsession with the end of the world and her doomsday prepping with co-star Morgan Spector. And we talked about the White Lotus, filming White Lotus season 3 in Thailand and even a little bit of Broadway too. So it was quite a fun one.
So I noticed the Gilded Age's second season blow up a little bit online. It seemed like more people were talking about it. This is Julian Fellowes' follow-up to Downton Abbey set in Old World New York, as Christine Baranski loves to call it. And I'm sure she noticed the increased attention around the show this time around.
Oh, absolutely. I think she not only noticed, but credits the Gilded Age's renewal to the fact that so many people were talking about it online. And so, you know, a subset of like-minded people, a lot of, you know, gays and girlies really falling for the show and tweeting their support, hate tweeting out too. It all contributes. It all contributes to a season 3 renewal. And she's definitely forever grateful. And she's online. She's reading those tweets.
She's reading those tweets. All right, well, let's hear about that in your conversation with Carrie Coon.
Carrie, I gotta say, I'm so excited to talk to you again. And specifically, the last time we talked, we were not sure about the fate of the Gilded Age. And now we know for certain that it's coming back for season 3. So congratulations. Everybody I know is thrilled. Can you talk about how you found out and your expectations and how you're feeling about stepping back into Bertha Russell's shoes?
I think how I found out was I was circling the White Lotus. I was in talks with the White Lotus when my agent said, just so you know, the confidential information suggests that this might be happening. And that was kind of the first inkling I got. And so I was thrilled. And, you know, honestly, it's the people watching it. The streaming numbers, I think, were just undeniable in a way maybe they hadn't been first season. We were most certainly on the bubble. As you know, I was feeling very cynical about it.
Yeah,
I was not hopeful.
Were.
I was telling everybody I knew we were canceled.
Yeah.
or just not brought back, I should
not
say.
Not brought back yet, yeah.
But no, I'm excited. I know nothing about the storyline yet, so I'm excited to read.
Yeah. I honestly, as one of the people who was tweeting out and being like, we must save Gilded Age, once I saw that you were cast in The White Lotus, I was like, how on earth could this possibly work scheduling-wise? So I don't know what you can tell me. How are you making that work?
Well, fortunately, it actually lined up pretty perfectly. I think we're going to go into production on Gilded Age in July. And although White Lotus will continue shooting in July, I will probably wrap out by June just so they can get me back for Gilded Age. So the fact that I think the both shows are on HBO definitely worked in my favor because everyone's incentivized to make sure everything works out. I'm very grateful to the people. And, you know, it's always boots on the ground. It's always like the first ADs and, you know, everybody kind of working together on the schedule.
Wow. Well, as someone who's
ask me about my husband and my kids. That's a whole other problem, okay?
Well, you did mention, we should say, you're not feeling that well. Oh, the kids, man. I feel bad. I'm so sorry that you're not feeling that well.
I'm abandoning them. I'm going back to Thailand, and my husband is taking care of the children. And it's a very modern marriage over here, Chris.
That is a very modern marriage, which is kind of, actually, that's
a good segue?
A good segue if we think about Bertha Russell and and her husband, right? They're sort of bringing marriage, they're the new generation, the new money, and doing marriage a little bit differently than their friends across the street, if you will.
That's so true. We hear Agnes alluding to the pains of her marriage, which are, you know, and as you point out, very common. A lot of marriages of convenience. And clearly, you know, Bertha and George are in a marriage that is for love and some other things. And also, you know, their ambition, clearly. I mean, they're working on in parallel, as we've talked about before, and it's and it's respectful. And even when they fall out personally, they keep their eye on the prize, they show up for each other, and they work it out. It's very, I don't know, it's very progressive.
And what will Mrs. Winterton make of all this? Or don't you care?
Should I care about the feelings of a former lady's maid who attempted to seduce my husband?
May I find hope in your use of the word attempted?
It was never her claim that hurt me, but your silence.
Will you forgive me now?
If I do, enjoy it. There will be no more forgiveness if you hide any such thing from me again.
It is very progressive, and I do say, I do think, obviously, you know, you're not married to Morgan Spector in real life, but when he wore that shirt, that Bertha Russell fan cam shirt, I was like, this is a real, real relationship. This is really
That's
fantastic.
Right, and I may have an answer to that shirt, and you may see it someday soon.
Ooh.
But yes, I was very tickled by that. And Morgan and I are great friends. And of course, I adore Rebecca Hall, and they adore Tracy. And we're just, you know, we're a great foursome. We're a really, we're a good time. Except Morgan and I talk about the end of the world a lot. But otherwise, we're a great time.
Do you?
Yeah, that's whenever anyone's around us on set, it's just, they're like, can you guys stop? We were talking about having like a doomsday podcast or...
I would tune into that, I have to say. Not to encourage that. I know you're very busy, but, you know, I would absolutely listen.
Yeah, that's the only reason we haven't done it is because we really don't have time, but maybe someday.
Oh, wow. I will say, while we're on the subject of the Gilded Age, we talked, and I actually wound up, like, you sent me to Wikipedia talking about your Vanderbilt's, Alma's relationship with Consuelo, her daughter, and how that could be the shape of the next season. I know you said you don't know what might happen, but...
I don't know, but a big wedding seems like a good plan, doesn't it?
Yeah, especially after what Bertha did with, you know, Gladys and the Duke, right?
Oh, you mean looking out for her daughter's well-being?
Well, some would say that, but others would say... You're selling her off, maybe, for money and power?
She doesn't know what she needs, Chris. She doesn't know what's good for her, okay? The world is not built for her, and I am looking out for her. Bertha is not the villain here.
And the thing is, you really, it is so great because Bertha is so strong. She makes choices that many can say, I don't know about that one. And yet it's sort of impossible not to root for her in such a fabulous way. I got it. Like, it really is such a seminal, such a great performance.
Thank you. She's really, I mean, she drives the narrative. That's always, just in storytelling, I have an advantage because Morgan and I are driving the momentum of the show. And that's always attractive in storytelling. We just naturally are interested in what's creating motion and energy. So we're cheating a little bit in that regard, but it's so fun. I mean, we appreciate that level of ambition and craft. You have to have a healthy respect for it, for the people that get ahead and the skills they possess. Which is why Turner is such a formidable foe. Maybe we talked about this a little bit. Because Turner, what I love what they've done with Turner, and Kelly Curran, who's like the nicest person in the world, is so unhinged and such a delightful. It's so delicious.
It's such a
great performance. Isn't it? How she's leaning in. It's great.
Batty performance and exactly the way you want it to.
So fantastic. And the thing that's brilliant is that they've made her, she has such good taste. She's incredibly classy and it just makes her incredibly formidable. And I think Bertha looks at her and says, I don't know if I could have done what she's done. Mm. And you have to respect, like, it's a kind of supportive meritocracy, right? It's like these people have, they're achieving by their wits. And Bertha absolutely respects that. And she will respect anybody who's able to do that.
Mm, yeah. Wow. Now I'm like, wow, maybe it's a Turner Bertha link up for season three. Maybe they join forces and they take on.
I mean, that would be, we'd take over the whole world.
Take over the whole world. First the
opera.
And
make a lot of enemies.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina,
the fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company,
and why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
I would love to know. I mean, you go from season three renewal to a SAG nomination for Best Ensemble. How was that experience? Did you get to go, or were you?
No, I was in Thailand.
Well, that would actually make sense.
But it's always a pleasure to be recognized by your peers. I mean, those are the people who you're going to work with and whose work you respect. And to be recognized by them is always the most satisfying. You know, there's so much content right now. I don't know how anybody can keep up with watching for the Emmys. I mean, you know, you've got to watch a bunch of stuff.
There is a
it's
lot
impossible.
Of stuff.
It's impossible.
Yeah.
I can't believe there are TV movies still. I haven't seen a TV movie since the 80s.
I don't even know what that means anymore.
Right? And it's like, there's so much to watch. And so to know that somehow we've broken through and we're appealing to our compatriots is always satisfying. And so it'd be nice to see if more people watch. Look, it's entertaining, and frankly, we've talked about this. The world feels really oppressive and terrible right now.
Yeah,
and scary,
yes, it
and
does.
The future feels really tenuous. And sometimes you just need to sit down and watch a Julian Fellowes show.
Yeah. That is so true. I will say that is very true. And speaking of the world being bad and having very little to look forward to, Mike White's White Lotus is actually one of the only things that I am looking forward to. And the cast that's been assembled is so, I couldn't have thought of it in my wildest dreams, and yet it's beyond my wildest dreams. Can you talk about the ensemble? And I know, you know, you're in the middle of it right now, but really, I just want to know what it's been like so far shooting in Thailand.
I'm not allowed to talk about the show, of course.
Yes,
I've signed
of course.
An NDA, but you guys all know who's cast, so I
yes,
think that's safe territory. Mike is he's really brilliant at casting. There are many moments, I think, when people go, huh, that person's playing that, and then you go, oh, like you start to understand, I see why this person's playing this, because he sometimes will put together actors who have very different styles and approaches, and yet he's very good at taking care of everybody because he's an actor himself, and he's very funny, but he's very smart director, and he gives excellent direction, and I adore him. And he doesn't approach everybody the same. You know, it's not just Mike coming at you as Mike. Mike is very sensitive to where actors are in their process. And I've watched him navigate different people. And it's just, I mean, it's a huge cast. It's an international cast. Mm. And I think he's just playing with some really interesting dynamics. And I think it's something he would continue to do if they let him. You know, because I think he would like to get bigger and more international and like sort of put together weirder groups of people. I think that's what he's passionate about. And I think that's important in this world.
Yeah.
To see people banging up against each other in this way. It's also, of course, he's satirizing like rich white people. Of course.
Of course.
And he's doing it very well. And he's really speaking to people who need to be spoken to, I think, in a really interesting way. And I think he's also said like, this is sort of, he had a season about money. He had a season about sex and this is his season about death. And so here we are in this Buddhist country. And it's just, I just love what he's working on. And it really bumps up against some things in my own life right now that are really interesting to think about. And so I'm feeling incredibly gratified, and my family is incredibly stressed.
I can only imagine. Oh, wow. I love that. And the satire of regarding rich white people. I mean, it's sort of hard to be like,
I mean, they lived in those Newport mansions for 6 weeks, Chris. We talked about this. They lived in those mansions for 6 weeks out of the year.
That is so crazy.
And they changed. They had like 220 dresses or something in that 6 weeks.
Yeah.
It was bananas. Talk about excess. I mean,
that was the Gilded Age version of a stay at the White Lotus, you know, just
and
nice
the White Lotus
vacation.
Is still about that, like the clothes, right? The fashion, all of that's become a big deal. And it's because of, you know, the way these people behave. Which is often not well.
Which is exactly what we want to see on screen, though. I mean, that's why
you love to see the fall of a person like that. You love to see a comeuppance. You love to see people learn something. You love to see yourself a little bit when there's some distance and you can sort of step back and say, oh, maybe... maybe I resemble that remark.
Yeah,
you know,
maybe,
I think it's healthy. That's what art at its best will do. That it's holding up a mirror to nature. Thank you, Shakespeare. But that's true.
It really is, and it's so fun and so interesting. And I think just like looking at your career. I mean, we've talked about the stage, and I'm a huge, you know, saw you in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
You nerd.
Yeah, I know. And I loved it. But to see from that to The Leftovers to Gilded Age to now White Lotus, like there are so many different ways and so many different characters that you've taken on that hold this mirror up to society in very, you know, different facets and different time periods. Do you see a through line or do you just go from project to project? How do you navigate that?
No, I think the charm of my path has been that I wasn't one of those kids who knew I was going to be an actor necessarily. Mm-hmm. I mean, I knew I was interested in it. I can't lie and say that I wasn't because I was. There was no room for it in my family's lives. And so, mm-hmm. So I came to it as, you know, late. And I'm glad I did because I had a really full and interesting life up to that point and got to study some interesting things and study abroad, which is what I always tell young actors to do. It's like, read books and travel and meet people and like have a life, you know?
Then
it will inform whatever work you do. And so I was always really just open to what the path might be and always open to changing direction if the path closed. And so for that reason, I don't have my sights set on anything in particular. And so I'm really open to the opportunities that come. And fortunately for me, I'm really proud of my IMDb page. I think there's a lot of great stuff on there. And I've worked with some amazing showrunners and, you know, Damon and Noah Hawley and now Mike. And I've just been really, really lucky. And I don't know what accounts for it. I mean, I know what I'm doing. Like, I know I'm not like, I can't believe they keep hiring me. Like, that's disingenuous, right?
Yes,
I work
yes,
hard. Like, I'm working hard.
Of course.
I'm trying to get better. I watch myself. I try to identify what some of my habits are.
Mm.
I read everything. I read all the reviews. I read good reviews. I read
you
bad
do.
Reviews. Oh,
people
I love it. I read.
People don't watch themselves and people don't read reviews. So how does
that? And I think it's, you know, look, we're all going to die. You know, and nothing
podcast.
Somebody writes in an article is going to be the thing that kills me. A lot of other things are going to kill me, but that's not one of them. And I understand like if you're working on stage and you're reading reviews while you're on stage, you can get stuck in your head on that stuff. But also like, I don't know, I like to know how the work's being received in the world. I think it's important. I think I'm interested in that conversation about what art is doing. Mm. And I'm part of what's doing the art. And I feel like I have some responsibility to understand how that work is landing in the world and to sort of help me hone in on the kind of things I'm interested in participating in or what's something that I don't think I want to put my name on. And so, I don't know, I'm just rambling now.
No,
I can't remember
not.
The question. But
no, I love it. No, that is really fantastic in terms of like the breadth of your career and I think you really answered how you remain always great, which is sort of what we're talking about is actors who just are constantly fantastic in whatever they're put in. And I do think that lack of vanity because it's hard. I mean, you know, from
I'm 43, man. It's hard. You know, it's hard.
Yeah,
this is the age where women's careers were over not that long ago.
Yeah, that is
so
such
it's
a
kind
good
of
point.
Amazing that it's changed, but I mean, the pressures are still there. But at least there are some stories for us to tell now. Not enough. I mean, I think this was the fewest number of leading lady roles for the Oscars in like a decade or something.
Wow, I didn't
so it's
realize
not like
that.
Equity's not getting better. Quick.
Mm-hmm. And you
TV are, is better than film.
TV is better than film. Well, I've been following, I mean, I follow you on Twitter and I know you love the Gilded Age mean tweets, but I've been
very
really
political.
I love it. And I also love your actual like digital your physical catalog of media and of movies and television shows and how, you know, how you really are engaging not only with your own work but with you know, the work that is happening writ large.
Yeah, and foreign films. I mean, I think so many people are sleeping on extraordinary foreign film that's not always available on streaming. And, you know, there's some incredible movies out there. But I interrupted you to plug foreign films.
No, you can interrupt me whenever you want. But that curiosity is so
And you just said
important.
It, Chris, curiosity. And that's true, by the way, I think in any profession. It's not just ours. It's important in ours. It's important in like the kind of people that you're going to be friends with for the rest of your life. Because I'll tell you what incurious people do. They never ask you a question about yourself.
They really don't. And I...
Nope.
They really
that's
don't do
that. That's a narcissist,
that.
Chris.
Yes, I see a lot of them. And I'm used to interviewing people because that's my job in many ways. But I always now notice like when you're at dinner, when you're with people, and they just... Mm-hmm. People feel very comfortable not asking you any questions.
Anything at all. And that's not very interesting to be around.
It is not.
And it's not interesting to act with either.
Okay, well,
you know, and I don't encounter that often. I think actors generally are like, kind of the most curious people.
Totally.
So we get a bad rap because you always, you know, if somebody acts out, that's the story you hear, but you don't hear about the many hundreds of thousands of actors who are incredibly generous and grateful. And yeah, there are narcissists too, of course.
For sure.
But there are narcissists at a bank.
Yeah.
You know, like there are finance narcissists. They're everywhere.
Oh yeah. Oh, absolutely. They really are everywhere. And that, mm-hmm. yeah, that curiosity about other people and is so, that's what generates interesting work, which is, I think all that we're looking for is, you know, it balloons and balloons and we get mm-hmm. more and more shows and whatnot. We're looking for people who consistently do interesting work and make interesting choices, which also leads to, I mean, this is not even, you've got Gilded-ish, you've got White Lotus, you also have Ghostbusters coming this summer, which is completely,
just opened.
Yeah.
It's completely different. I'll say that's a big studio movie. That's a, that's a different world. You know, it's not a world I'm used to.
Yeah. How was that? How was shooting that? What is that?
It was interesting. You know, Afterlife felt like an independent film. When Jason came to me with Afterlife, it felt like making an indie with Jason in Canada. And this one felt more like a studio movie because we were on the stages. We were shooting in England. Mm. So that corner of Tribeca was built in a studio. And it just felt bigger. You know, it felt like a bigger situation. I'm not as accustomed to that stuff. Certainly not as accustomed as like Paul Rudd is.
Yeah, that is fair.
You don't have input when you're working on a big film like that. Like I'm not like, let me give the studio my notes. You know, that's not happening.
They're not.
What I'm really signing up for then is an experience. And the experience I'm signing up for is to be with those people. And I got to sit around in a green room with Annie Potts and Dan Aykroyd and you know, Paul Rudd and Kumail Nanjiani and all the kids who are very savvy and need no advice. I've said this before. I'm just like, I have nothing to offer these children. They all have like side hustles. They're all, you know, social media stars.
I would ask for advice from them, you know?
Honey, it's
they might
crazy.
Know some things. But
they do. And it's wild. But like, you know, to talk about Annie Potts, about working with John Hughes, and to hear Dan Aykroyd just tell stories about the early days of SNL and about Belushi. And I mean, that stuff is really special. And so anymore, as I'm getting older and I have a family, and like any job I take is time away from my family. So what is important to remember in an actor's life, like my life is being lived on set in that experience. My life isn't lived when the movie comes out, that happens on the internet.
Yeah.
That happens on Deadline. Mm-hmm. Like how a movie gets received in the world I can't control any of that. The only thing I control is the experience I'm having when I'm living my life.
Yeah.
And so I got to have this extraordinary time with these legends, you know? And then watch this new crop of actors who are up and coming. Like McKenna Grace isn't going anywhere. You know, Finn Wolfhard isn't going anywhere. Mm. Celeste O'Connor is just starting to kind of bloom. Logan Kim, God willing, will get another job, you know, out of this work. And so it's delightful and moving for me to be around that. And so for me, it's all about the experience of making the thing. And I try to show up every day and work hard and know my lines and try to have fun and not bring my doomsday attitude to set.
We keep coming back to that. And I want to know more.
It's tricky.
Because that is the
Mormons know how to make a disaster pantry. So let me just say, if you have any questions, you look to the Mormons because they've got it all figured out.
That is the headline of this. Carrie Coon says, look to the Mormons.
It's like, oh, she's lost her mind. My husband's like, yes, in fact, she has. Yeah. We got to figure out how to run the DVD player with a bicycle, you know, when the grid goes down. So that's my next challenge. I'm sure somebody can give me advice about that. But like, that's what it's about the experiences. You know, I'm having this incredible, I have this incredible job in Thailand, this coveted job with this like totally wacky group of actors that will never work in the same thing ever again. Especially because, you know, you have women of the same age in a project.
So many.
Usually there's one
and there's like multiple.
Maybe two.
And I was like, we got like three or four here and
I know.
Love that.
And it's great. And it's great. And it's great for the soul. And it's great for, you know, talking to other women about navigating this very strange life. Mothers or not mothers, you know, everybody has something to offer. And so I don't know. And just like, again, being just like really moved by the kids who are so fantastic. And like the young people that I've been around, they have such very fine heads on their shoulders. They're very impressive to me. They're so much less naive than I was, but in like not a cynical way.
Yeah.
You know, they're actually hopeful too. And they work hard.
That is
good. I really respect them.
The hopefulness is so great. I'm now wondering too. I mean, you and Tracy are both, you know, luminaries of the stage and screen, and you have children. Do you think your children will, you know, pursue a life of the mind, of the arts, if you will?
I'll tell you, my son is obsessed with books and Japanese Godzilla movies from the 1960s.
Great.
And he has this wacky auditory memory. So he can watch something once and basically he can recite almost the whole thing. We don't understand that. It's very freaky. But he's a storyteller.
Yeah.
My daughter seems to like, I think she could care less about school. He loves going to school. She doesn't care, but yeah. She sings and she paints. And I think she's probably an artist. And I think I'm never going to be able to tell her what to do. She doesn't listen to me now. She's 2.5. She's like, I'm going to go have a cookie. And she just goes into the pan. I'm like, oh,
well,
okay.
There she goes.
Cookie for dinner.
Sounds
I'm
like
done with my lunch, you know, taking a nap. You're like, okay, bye.
Great.
So I don't know.
Self-possessed. I love that. Sounds like
it's
an
incredible.
Actress to me.
It will serve her well. It's going to kill me. But
isn't that always the case?
Oh, totally. And, you know, of course, what they have is the incredible privilege of probably being able to be artists because we, my husband and I came from pretty humble, middle, lower class lives. Mm-hmm. him more lower, mine a little bit more middle.
Yeah.
And now our kids are being raised in tremendous privilege. And this is a schema that my husband and I don't have because this is not how we were raised.
It's new.
It's our responsibility to raise kids who are not total a-holes.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think the way you do that is they read books and they see movies and art. And I think what the world is missing is our country's fundamentally hostile to the arts. And
yes.
We're seeing it in our young people. They're not given resources and outlets, music and art. And, you know, especially in some of these public schools that are being defunded.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hurting their souls. You know, and my kids have access to that stuff. My kids are going to be fine.
Yeah.
But there are many, many children who don't have that outlet and who aren't being exposed to these things, which teach you how to be a human being in the world. You know, the best art does that. And the fact that we are being deprived of that access, it's intentional.
Yeah.
It keeps people down. It keeps people from hoping and dreaming and making changes.
And imagining a bigger world for themselves, because that's what art is supposed to be.
Correct. And like that, the world we've built isn't functioning. And we have to change it, but it will take such big dreams to change it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we got to get out of the doomsday locker to do it. And we're going to do it.
I know. I can talk the talk. I'm talking the talk.
You're talking the talk. I believe in you. I believe in you. But I will listen to that podcast, I got to say.
I'll tell Morgan.
Please do. I know we only have a little bit of time left, but I have to ask, and this is, you know, personally, I'm so happy that you're booked and busy. Of course, that's so wonderful for everybody. I am a little disappointed. That means we probably won't see you on stage in August, Osage County.
Well,
you know, I was looking forward to that. But
Chris, nobody will produce it.
I will produce it.
Chris, look, if you can get a group of people together, we will make a mint.
I know
some
people.
Because it's a great play. It's a great play. And Broadway is struggling so much right now.
It is.
The theater is not recovered.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also inaccessibly expensive.
Absolutely true.
And that's a problem. That's a problem. And like, we can't expect to like foster this interest in young people if they can't afford to come to the theater.
Yeah.
How? Or if they can't afford to live in New York City.
Well, there there we go.
You know what I mean?
Say that.
So we got a lot of work to do, but I would love to do the play, my goodness. And I think it's so relevant. People who haven't heard it since the time it was on Broadway, I mean, if you listen to it now, it's a real period piece. But man, did it see what was coming. And it's chilling. The language in it is really chilling. And it's funny.
And it's funny. Yeah.
It's terrifying. It's funny.
It's funny. It's terrifying. Well, okay. We just got to make sure we got to block out 6 to 9 months from your schedule and then
produce
it and we'll get,
okay.
And then we'll lower the ticket prices and we'll lower the rent in New York altogether.
Yes, we're going to do it.
We'll save the nation and we'll save
the
arts.
You are a hopeful person, Chris.
I'm trying. I try.
See, what a delight.
That does it for this week's show. We'll be back on Thursday to talk about Shogun and the season finale, as well as the limited series race overall. In the meantime, you can always find us on the internet. Email us at littlegoldmen@vf.com or find me on the internet at davidcanfield97 and Chris.
And you can find me on the internet at Chris Triss.
And our editor and producer is Brett Fuchs.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson.
Oh.
Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.